Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Nicole Manlove, and I am a Library and Information Science graduate student at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Today is Friday, December 5th, 2014, and in collaboration with Wayne State University and the Walter P. Reuther Archives Library, I am conducting an oral history interview with Danielle Wilkins, President and CEO of the Detroit-based Green Door Initiative, an environmental justice and education organization that is helping to develop, promote, protect, support, and maintain a natural and healthy environment within Detroit and its surrounding community. Not only has Ms. Wilkins' work been recognized in multiple environmental justice publications, she has also been the recipient of various awards and fellowship for advocacy within and outside the city of Detroit. Ms. Green, I would first like to thank you for taking the time to sit down with me. Your contribution is greatly appreciated, and will prove to be a valuable asset to Wayne State, the Reuther Archives, and the Detroit metropolitan community. Can you begin by clearly stating your full name?
Yes. My name is Danielle Wilkins.
Okay, and would you mind telling me a little bit about yourself, such as where you were born and raised, your educational background, and what inspired you to become involved in environmental justice and education?
I'm a lifelong Detroiter. I grew up in the city of Detroit, educated in the city of Detroit, Detroit Public Schools, attended Castec High School. I attended Wayne State University as well, didn't complete my higher education. I'm actually in the process of doing that now. But I can say that I've had a long history of advocacy and nonprofit management, and starting back in the 80s when I served in the labor movement, in leadership capacities, as well as being employed by local labor organizations, and even worked for a short time with a national organization at the national level, the American Federation of Teachers. And that's where I really got baptized, if you will, into advocacy work. But I found a kinship around occupational health and safety initially. Worked for an organization in the late 80s and early 90s called SMCOSH, the Southeast Michigan Coalition on Occupational Safety and Health. And that's where I really learned about the disparities, particularly among African-American workers compared to other folks in the labor movement, especially when it came to workplace health and safety, the disproportionate number of folks, particularly African-Americans, that were harmed on the job, had the least experience in advocating on their behalf, being seen often in the dirtiest, low-paying jobs in some of the harshest industries like factories and places like that. And I found I discovered a real passion for helping to sort of create some capacity, if you will, among folk so that they can be healthier and have a better outcome in their work life. That is the initial step that got me to the environmental justice work. Because of the work that I was doing around occupational health and safety, being a non-traditional sort of individual in that kind of work, I got a lot of attention, to be honest. And one of the people who paid attention to me happened to be a professor at the University of Michigan. I was really impressed with the leadership role and the voice that I created within that environment. I did some work and created a project called the Minority Occupational Health Project. Okay. That got national attention, actually, and really created, filled a void for Black leadership around health and safety. Dr. Bunyan Bryant from the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment happened to be working with a national initiative to address what we know now today as environmental justice. They were pulling together a forum that would begin to build a movement around environmental justice. He thought I would be an ideal candidate to represent our area as a delegate to that process. And when I accepted and participated in this 1991 national conference called the First People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit, that's where I discovered my life work.
Okay. And just to, I guess, reiterate a few things. You've been, let's say, active within this realm of work, let's say, for about 20 years or
about
so?
About 20 years, yes. I've spent, 2 decades in doing this work. We were charged with starting a movement when we left that 4-day important conference. People from all over the country came together, uniting and saying, look, we're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And we were charged with return to your communities and start a movement. And I just took that very seriously and did that.
Okay. And just to, again, reiterate for our listeners and readers, you basically fight to, you fight against what some would consider to be environmental racism.
Right. The whole movement around environmental justice is the goal that we hope to attain, justice, not for the environment, for people who are disproportionately impacted by environmental pollution, poor policies, inadequate policies, that equals unequal protection under the law when it comes to environmental protection. Typically, people of color and poor people are the ones that carry that greatest burden. So places like Detroit, where in the county of Wayne, the majority of people of color are concentrated for the state of Michigan. And of course, we know how Detroit fares with that. And like any other place, the location of polluting facilities often are aligned where people of color live. That's the number one criteria or characteristic, if you will, that helps to support this idea of environmental racism. So it's your race is the number one factor, income is the second factor. And all the data and great research and stuff that's been done, that continues to be the indicator for where polluting facilities and pollution reigns. And so Wayne County and the city of Detroit are not unique to that. 87% of the known polluting facilities are inside the city of Detroit in the county of Wayne, where you get the majority of people of color. And then you factor poverty levels with that, and yes, we are the hot spot in the state of Michigan. So that's why the term environmental racism is important, and that's where it comes from.
Okay, excellent. And again, just to kind of describe your role in environmental activism, you would classify yourself as a, I guess simultaneously as an educator, consultant, trainer, administrator, and of course advocate.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, what really drove me to even serve in this capacity, one of the things, the additional thing, in addition to just being an advocate for what I believe is just and what's right, is to be a model in our community in leading the work and being a voice and a face so that others in our community would be motivated by whatever leadership I'm able to display. So I want folks, particularly African Americans and women, to know mm-hmm. that we can lead efficient, effective organizations, and we can be a voice for what's right and not shrink from that. And so that's the other driver behind why I do what I do. And what I recognize is that there was really no forum or place for this work established in the city of Detroit at the time. So I started in my living room and invited folks to come and let's talk about this. Is this something that we should pursue in the city of Detroit? And as we reached out, more and more people agreed with that. Ultimately, we ended up creating an organization in the mid-90s that got us really going. And I served as the founding director and leader of that organization for like 15 years with Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. And out of my living room, we had nothing. When I left that organization in 2010, we had a budget of $2 million annually, and we had staff that looked like the folks in our community, and we just developed the capacity to force equal protection under the law when it comes to environmental protection. And you find places like Wayne County that has failed to meet the Clean Air Act and other important environmental statutes. It is very clear that there's a link between environmental exposure and health outcomes in our community, folks not being able to breathe, a preventable disease like asthma, lead poisoning, and other things that's attributed to environmental exposures. We had to have exert ourselves and place a voice there. And why not us?
Oh, absolutely. Now, I know that in the beginning you did kind of tell us a little bit about how you got started, you know, within the realm of environmental justice. Would you mind just elaborating a little bit more on some of the other programs, activities, and some of the ideas that you were involved or implemented in prior to founding the Green Door Initiative?
Sure. So my work at Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice really set the foundation for advocacy and social justice around environmental justice. And in the early days, our goal was to ensure that environmental justice became a household phrase. And assert that as an agenda for social justice at a number of levels, especially at the political policy decision-making levels, like the city of Detroit, the state of Michigan, and even at a federal and a national level, we added to the voice there. But some of our early fights that we were successful at accomplishing, we contributed early on to an issue that helped to protect another city in our state, Flint, Michigan. There was a proposal back in the early 90s to build an incinerator that was under the guise of generating energy, alternative energy. Mm-hmm. But what they were doing was creating that energy by burning demolition debris that would come from the city of Detroit. And demolition debris that most likely contained lead and other things, and they were going to build this facility in a black neighborhood in Flint, Michigan. So being that we were getting involved in this whole environmental justice piece, it's like we can't be a contributor or aid to this. Though we weren't able to stop the facility itself, what we did was stop Detroit from being the major provider of the raw material that would go into that facility. What we did do, even though we weren't able to stop the facility being built, we were able to present testimony that reduced the level of any lead-based containing material that would go into that facility. So in some way, we reduced the health impact that that facility could bring to that community. That was our very first effort. We have since shut down medical waste facilities. One such thing was with Henry Ford Health Systems. Henry Ford Health, the hospital itself, made a decision in the late 90s to discontinue burning their medical waste, which was a good thing. So they shut down all of the facilities that existed in the suburban communities, but decided to keep the one in Detroit open and to increase its capacity to receive all of the trash from those facilities they shut down in the suburbs. We received a call, right? And basically it was like, you know, this is happening and this is not going to be good for the community. And we definitely pulled together an effort to stop that. And what takes normally 8 years to do, we did that in a year and a half. We stopped that facility from increasing its capacity. We provided them alternative mechanisms to meet the state requirement for how to manage their medical waste.
Okay.
And it was done in a way that did not contribute to air pollution and just the other issues. There was a lot of things that went into that effort. The hospital threatened to shut its doors. And, you know, the threat to the community was that we're not going to have a hospital because these extremists are making us do something that is just as extreme and not necessary. So we had to fight those kind of efforts from the hospital, and even the county health department was definitely on the side of the hospital, and we're trying to really keep this facility going to keep it going forward. So, you know, we had a small but mighty group of people that joined with us, including some really fearless senior citizens in the neighborhood,
okay,
who was tired of dealing with all the things that came with them burning their medical waste in the first place. We were successful. Now today, not only does the hospital still exist, it created a department within the hospital that never existed before, and that was an environmental department. Now they recycle and they do some things to keep stuff from going into the incinerator, and they manage the 5% that they were supposed to apply some level of heat to, like the biological waste. That was reduced from 100% to 5% because they were burning like household waste, stuff from the cafeteria, stuff coming out of the emergency room like scalpels and stuff. They were wasting a lot of money.
Okay.
So on top of creating a problem for the community, they were just wasting money in their own facility. Now they're saving money. They hired more people because they created this department, and we reduced the burden of pollution. Our position at the time was, our kids deserve to breathe clean air like anybody else's kid.
Absolutely.
Right? And this, to us, translated into environmental racism. And we worked to ensure that our community got the justice it deserved.
Okay.
So that was an example of a great win and effort that we were engaged in. And then that shortly after we won that effort, we joined some folks at the state level, and we were able to get some policy instituted at the state level around how hospitals and facilities manage their medical waste. So, you know, just the struggle of building a bike and riding it to trying to ensure that, you know, what's happening to us today, we can protect ourselves and guard ourselves, but also ensuring that policy is changed and shifted in a way that doesn't allow this to happen in the future.
Okay. Oh, great. And I noticed, too, that when I was doing some research on you, that you've been a very, very busy woman, to say the least. Would you be able to, I guess, elaborate on some of the organizations that you are a part of simultaneously with the Green Door Initiative?
Sure. I mean, coalition building and working in collaboration is the only way we can survive and do this work. In the early days, I felt really alone, like, what the heck? You know, who else has done this work or whatever? And I found a lot of support outside of our community, the national work in particular. And so I got connected early on with folks doing this work from around the country. One of the notable organizations is the National Black Environmental Justice Network, that, by the way, formed in 1999. And our first meeting was launched in New Orleans, Louisiana. And that's really critical because everybody and anybody that happened to be African American doing work on this issue convened in this important meeting. 300 people were in that meeting. 30 states were represented. I like to say it was from welfare moms to PhDs there, all with the goal of reducing the burden of toxins in our communities. And what was interesting, why did we choose New Orleans, Louisiana, is because we felt that that was the place where things were going to pop off. If anything horrible was going to happen in our community, would start in New Orleans. And here in 2005, Katrina hit. And Katrina was linked to climate change, global warming, and a number of things that come along with climate change. So we were on the cutting edge of what was not right in our community, knowing that New Orleans would be the first one. And we know what the story is behind that, the breaking of the levees and all the devastation that occurred. And who was most impacted by that? African-American people. So that work has been very important because I was able to link with folks from all over the country, and I still am in relationship with them. So an organization at that level that I'm involved with is a group called the Environmental Justice Leadership Forum. And that forum works to ensure that there's justice in the policy around climate change. And we lend our voice from Detroit and from Michigan in that process. And we're really clear that a lot of the things that are important in the environmental justice movement are at odds with the traditional environmental movement. And many people in the environmental justice movement does not even sort of self-define themselves as environmentalists. I'm one of those people.
Okay.
Because I think what happens with the more traditional environmental arena is that the focus is less on people and more on the natural, you know, creation, and that's important. But we're finding that without people being considered in this process, folks die prematurely and are affected health-wise, and that's our priority, okay? So when it comes to climate change, for instance, a lot of their priorities, that being the traditional environmental organizations, are at odds with what our priorities are and how we see policy moving forward that would protect everybody. Okay. So being at that level, offering what we think are the best approaches to reducing the impacts of climate change, particularly in communities of color and the poor, is very critical, because we can't leave it to folks who don't identify with our issues, right? So so issues around cap and trade and other things, we see it very differently from mainstream environmental groups. That being said, I'm also involved in one of the founders of the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition.
Okay.
And it's a statewide organization. We've worked to ensure that the state of Michigan enacts a policy around environmental justice. So I spent a lot of time on that effort. Michigan is behind the rest of the country when it comes to policies in place at the state level. And we want to see something like that done here so that vulnerable communities like Detroit and every place where the community has a disproportionate number of African Americans and or people of color in their communities, where that's where you're going to see the pollution align. So places like Pontiac, Flint, Saginaw, Detroit, of course, and parts of the west side of the state and whatever, often are the communities that are hosting these bad guys and bad players in our community. So working with MEJC is really critical in that. What other work am I doing? I've served on the NEJAC, the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, on the full council, and that's the council that provides advice to the US EPA, that provides an environmental justice voice to their public policy work to ensure the vulnerability of communities, the vulnerable communities in particular, are protected and considered. And a lot of times what I've done at that level, I've tried to bring to the state of Michigan and say, look, we can use the model that the federal government is using for engagement and advisement, bringing multiple departments and divisions together so that we can work across these spaces to ensure protection. I'll give you an example of that. NEJAC, the national group, has focused on making sure that, say, the Department of Agriculture and HUD and Department of Labor, EPA, all these folks, Department of Energy and whatever, come together to ensure that they're talking to one another. One reason for that is, let's give the example of HUD. HUD has put a lot of money into building public housing in places across this country, but unknowingly, maybe knowingly, building these public housing on top of contaminated sites, on top of old landfills and things like that,
okay,
without any input from the Environmental Protection Agency. So they place deliberately people in harm's way,
okay,
poor people, people without a voice, on top of, they're living on top of hazardous waste and materials and not knowing it. And so this is a practice of HUD.
I didn't know
well,
that.
Yeah, the same is with the Department of Education. Like, school districts do not have to answer to anybody about where they build a school. And in Detroit, they had built schools on top of contaminated sites and putting children in harm's way without policy that says that's wrong.
Okay.
So who gets to be in housing like that? Who gets to be in schools like that? Our community. Then we're blamed for not meeting the educational attainments, not you know, our children being violent and that kind of stuff. Well, we know what lead poisoning, for instance, does to children. It diminishes their capacity to thrive and to be educated. But how about recent research and stuff shows that it is a contributor to violence.
Okay.
In children in particular. Mm-hmm. So there was a study once done, I'm getting off tiring a little bit, but there was a study done at the University of Michigan looking at the most violent offenders at who had passed away at Jackson State Prison. The common thread they found in each of these prisoners, the most violent ones, they had been lead poisoned as children. The most vulnerable population in the community are African-American boys.
Right.
They are walking around, many of them, undiagnosed. But you're building prisons and stuff for them. If we start talking about some of the environmental factors that contribute to this, maybe we'll find solutions, right? So it's those kind of reasons why we do the work, and I've done the work that I've done, to like insert these conversations in places that you would not likely be talking to. And one of the hardest places that we've been doing that with in is the public health community.
Okay.
For instance, many of them have environmental health divisions, but they're not doing environmental health from our perspective. They're doing is important stuff, you know, rat control, let's go and review a restaurant, make sure they're serving good food and healthy food and whatever. But what they're not doing is looking at the impacts of air pollution on public health, lead on public health, you know, why disproportionately people in our community have asthma and those kind of things. So we bring that kind of thing to the table and say, look, you have to consider these things, expand your work. And there are resources to make that happen. This is always the question, you know, do we have the money to deal with that? Okay. We can't afford not to, right? So, my work there, and let me see what else. Is there something on your list that I didn't touch?
Well, I know just from doing some of the research, they mentioned that you were, I guess, part of the National Brownsville Conference.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And let's see, Green Jobs and Career Network.
Yeah.
There was actually quite a few.
Okay, I haven't touched on any of those things. But yeah, the other thing that was really important, and I sit on, and I'm an appointee to the Detroit Brownfield Redevelopment Authority. That was no small task, because when that was created during Dennis Archer's administration, when he was mayor back in the 90s, he established the authority because the federal government was saying, well, we're going to put some money in places that are burdened with contaminated sites. So, you know, of course, you had to create an authority, a decision-making body, to make that happen. What he wasn't interested in was having a community voice as part of that. So that was a fight we took on, and to ensure that the community had a voice in the space there. Now, he was thinking at the time, well, look, if we have to let community in on this, we'll place them in an advisory committee capacity. And that's cool, but your decisions really happen at the authority level. So that was a big fight, and we won that fight. We had to really advocate at the city council level and others, because that's where the decision had to be made. And the mayor made all of these appointees, but the city council gets one appointee. So I've been their appointee to the authority since its inception, like in 2000, 1999 or 2000. And that was definitely not something the mayor was happy about, to be honest. But I knew that without a voice that understood that decisions about cleaning up property and stuff shouldn't only be driven by the bottom line, like, it's just going to be a good piece of property we could use for some development. That's cool. We need economic justice, too. But we also need it to be driven by the severity of the issue. And the thing with brownfield, say, versus Superfund sites, I'm not sure if you know much about Superfund sites, but Superfund sites are considered to be national priority lists. They are so badly contaminated that you have to invest in health clinics and other things, and aside from cleanup, for it to protect that community. The problem with brownfields, how they became designated as brownfields, where we are, people of color are mostly, where the communities have the highest level designation of brownfield sites. These sites were removed from the national priority list, from the Superfund sites, yes.
Hmm. That's not good.
Exactly. And said, well, the reason that we need to do that is because we need people to feel confident in investing in places like Detroit. And Detroit, at that time, they stopped counting at 40,000 contaminated sites for the entire city and decided, like, we're going to designate the entire city a brownfield site, right? Now, there are some places within the city that really qualify to be Superfund sites.
Okay.
But like I said, to make it easier for developers to get have confidence in the city in that way, they wanted to remove the stigma, if you will, so and bring resources. You know, their thought is, if we can remove the stigma, we can then get confidence from a developer, and we can use the money for cleanup and whatever that way. But public health and stuff is not a driver. The economic bottom line is, which means that if you're living in a neighborhood where a site like that exists, but you're not attractive for development, you're not going to get attention.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? So if you're not going to get attention, people are living near, you know, properties that may have some kind of spill on it, maybe a transformer or something like that may have fallen in a playground or something. It's not considered a priority. But my children, my community is exposed to it,
mm-hmm.
right? So being at the table, my constant, you know, cry is, look, we need to, while this is happening, yeah, great that you're investing and finding ways to, you know, find ways to invest in Midtown and the city and downtown. We need to find ways to clean up properties outside of those hot spots for development.
Mm-hmm.
His being the former mayor at the time, being the mayor at the time, his biggest concern was that somebody like me would stop the process.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had that much power, right? So in the early days, it was really tough because everybody saw me as an enemy at the table, you know. But today, I'm not interested in standing in the way of progress. What I want to make sure is that the priority for public health and environment are established at the Brownfield Authority. I think that's where it should happen.
Okay.
So that's why what I do around green jobs and stuff is really critical, because if there's 40,000 parcels of contaminated property and other need to clean up, then there are jobs there.
Mm-hmm.
What are the what kind of skills and stuff need to be developed in our community so our community can compete for those job opportunities and do the cleanups or whatever, even creating their own businesses around it? So we created... I was the first one when I was serving at DWJ to launch a green jobs program in the state of Michigan.
Okay.
And then here at Green Door Initiative, that's one of our priority programs, is our environmental technician job training program. It's a very comprehensive training program. We target people who have barriers to employment, and it's difficult, chronically unemployed, and all those things. And we invest in them, and I'm really grateful for the record that we have. Since 2011, when we formally launched that program, we've trained 150 individuals, majority of them coming out of jail, prison, whatever, right, with those issues. And we have a good track record, 92% job placement and retention.
All right.
And, you know, people, we can see transformation in lives from it. And so we really think this is a good model. And it really does meet a need, not only in terms of the cleanup piece of this, we're also looking at the green up piece of this. And it's like, what do you do once you have a property that's clean? We need to do something with that property. Let's repurpose it so that it doesn't remain a targeted place for the stuff that's harmful. So we teach folks things like weatherization, energy auditing, installing solar panels and other things like that.
Okay.
So they can be competitive in the industry. In addition, they get certified and licensed in hazmat, asbestos, lead, and a number of other things. So there's this comprehensive investment that really allows them to be very competitive in the industry. We have some strong relationships with employers, mainly minority firms, especially because we really want to help them be competitive in the industry. We get them skilled individuals already trained and licensed. that's an investment they don't have to make in terms of the human capital, and then that just helped boost their ability to compete. So that's, you know, so one of the primary goals of the work that we do. We also do work with young people. Like to introduce the environmental sector to urban kids especially. Want them to know this is a good approach for their educational, future educational career goals, as well as any other career goals outside of that. And so we do things through our Youth Speak Green project to build that capacity. I'm really excited about a very new program that we have yet to launch, but it's called COLD, Climate Leaders Organizing Detroit. Climate Organizers Leading Detroit COLD. And it's really targeted at high school kids. Our goal is to get them engaged at the United Nations Youth Forum around climate change. And so we create a voice from Detroit that can contribute to the international policy making around climate change. Ultimately, we plan to take a group of young people next year, 2015, to the Paris meeting, where they can represent our community and, you know, just see a world that they have not been exposed to. And when we do that, we can see people looking at themselves and their community a little differently. But other things we've done in the past with young people, we've taught them how to do beach monitoring, like at Belle Isle Beach, and taking water samples and things like that, and determining if E. coli exists. You know, Detroit, Belle Isle has never been shut down because of E. coli or anything, not like what we hear from places like Metro Beach or whatever, right? Partly because there's no law that requires a beach to be shut down, but it's also about activism and leadership at the community level. So we've been notified that Belle Isle is worse than the Metro Beach any day. Right?
Oh yeah.
But no one ever has said you shouldn't go and fish at Belle Isle. You shouldn't go and swim at Belle Isle and whatever. And we want to bring attention to that, put some skills in young people's hands so they know how to do that.
Okay.
And be a voice for that. What else have we done? And of course our important work that we do has to do with just informing the regular community about important laws when it comes to environmental protection, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, safe drinking water and those kind of things, so they know there's a place for their voice in that as well, and
okay.
what to expect when it comes to equal protection under the law. So, you know, just we put a new face on the environmental movement. I'm not trying to say the aisle or the wheel. It's about people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, wow, you've definitely provided me with a lot of information. This is great. So thank you. And just to, I guess, reiterate, in regards to the this organization now, the Green Door Initiative, you actually founded the organization in 2010?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So it's almost 5 years old.
Yes.
And I know that going back to stating some of the organization's basic principles and objectives, you did talk about youth development and so forth. But I also noticed that you guys sometimes put on certain activities within the neighborhoods, like a neighborhood cleanup initiatives, various things such as festivals, fairs, and you know what have you.
Well, that's our way to get out into the community. Our community health awareness training seminars, chats, is the basis for it. And really want people to understand that this work is here in the city, and what we're intending to do is build an army of folks that can join with us to change what the city looks like and reshape it into this and create a green vision for the city of Detroit.
Okay.
So we are always lending ourselves to projects within the neighborhoods. And one way that we do that is especially in our job training piece, while we may be focused on job training, we're really trying to establish some social justice awareness among the trainees. So giving them something to do to give back
okay.
is really critical for us. And today, many of our students who didn't do that before they came into the program, you know, like be a part of a block club or volunteer in any capacity. Now they're doing that, right? So we got these guys coming back saying, hey, Ms. Wilkins, I'm now working as a, I'm volunteering with PAL League, or I started a block club, or whatever, you know. That's what we're trying to instill in the people that we serve as well. So whether we link with Arise Detroit or a similar organizations, we're trying as much as possible to have a presence in the community. Again, not to take over anybody else's agenda, but make sure that they're aware that this exists, and they can't, not that they can't, but we hope that they will at least say, yeah, this is something we should be focused on a little bit. So by being out there, giving back to our community, we are seen as contributors to changing the city, and that's what we want to do. So instilling that in the young people as well is really important to us, and so we're trying to figure out, always trying to figure out ways with their input to do that.
Now, I guess I'm curious to know, like, in your opinion, right now, like, what is the current state of the environment in Detroit, and what types of things do you see happening in the future?
Well, I have to say, that's a hard question because on one side, I want to be optimistic and say, I think things are improving. But, I mean, one of the biggest issues we've had over the years with our political leaders and whatever is this sort of this short-term commitment to bring jobs and stuff into our communities, which are important. But oftentimes, they've compromised. So right now, if you look at the stats, you could say that Detroit's air pollution, air quality has improved. Part of that is because there's not as much manufacturing going on. And I don't think that that would be the case if manufacturing was going on in the way that we're used to in our community. You know, we were dependent on the auto industry and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you could point to statistics and say, look, air pollution is improving, or air quality is improving. But if a factory showed up and said, look, we want to produce, they will do everything they can to fight any kind of permits and regulations that would require that employer to reduce its pollution. To give you an example of that, we've lost on two cases, Marathon Oil and another company called Servistal Metal, and or Steel, Servistal Steel. Both of these entities are major contributors to air pollution. And they have been successful at amending their permits so they can pollute more.
Okay.
So that's the conflict I have, you know. Like, yeah, these stats say this, but everywhere that you could compromise, the city and the state compromises. Mm-hmm. So we have a long way to go to get everybody on the same page with us.
Oh yeah.
Another issue that's a huge issue is the incidence of infant mortality. And where there are hot spots for air quality around air pollution, the level of infant mortality is greater. Okay. Detroit and some places in our city have the worst statistics than any third world country. And what we've been doing through our work with a project called DREAM, Detroit Reproductive Environmental Advocacy Matters Project with the University of Michigan, is bring attention to the environment and its impact on birth outcomes in our community. So what we have been able to prove through research and stuff that other folks are doing and doing some lit reviews and whatever around is that moms who are exposed to air pollution, particulate matter 2.5, are at greatest risk for having a preterm birth. And when you have a preterm birth, you increase the possibility of that child not even lasting the first year of its life. We want to see that decrease, right? So one of the policy things we're doing at the federal level, we've approached the EPA and said, look, here's the literature, and here's our position on this literature. We want you to consider pregnant moms a vulnerable population in your research and policy making, which right now is not the case. Okay. You would think that's a no-brainer, but it isn't. So it's those little things that we try to do. So is Detroit better off right now? No. Not until we see a reduction of those kind of statistics and babies living longer and healthier, you know, and moms being protected in a way that they can create that first environment and make it a safe environment for the unborn child. So that's, you know, those are the reasons why I hesitate to say we're better off. There's much work to be done. If we can get the state of Michigan to sign off on a policy for environmental justice, we will see a light at the end of the tunnel. We were successful at getting that done in Granholm's administration, but in this administration, they've done what they can to ignore that work, right? So that's an issue that says, yeah, things are not moving the way that we want it. And then the final example I would give you is the work that we're doing around the location of school sightings. Okay. And the fact that disproportionately schools are being built and located in really dangerous situations. Or no considerations for it. Say, for instance, I-94 is being proposed to be expanded. There are several schools along I-94. The only areas that I-94 would be most impacted is here on the east side. Mm-hmm. The state is required, MDOT is required to do what they call an environmental impact statement. And one way that you begin to do that is to create a baseline for, say, air quality. We want to see where we're starting before we build this thing, right? Okay. The failure, and this is required by law, what they've done to manipulate this process, they decided to do their baseline assessment in Livonia. This freeway expansion won't be anywhere near Livonia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Why would you do the baseline assessment there? Right?
That doesn't make any sense.
Makes no sense. There's nothing, there's a little element within the environmental impact statement that tells you to address health. Mm-hmm. An environmental impact statement does, you can't assume they will look at the potential health impacts. So our approach has been, we need you to do a health impact assessment. If you do that, we can predict what could be the potential outcomes if 10,000 new vehicles were allowed to come through this neighborhood and whatever, right? What will that do for the kids who are in school along this route? An environmental racist point to this, MDOT has a policy that says we will create barriers to protect the population from insults. But that doesn't kick in unless your property values are at a certain level.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you don't get new walls along the freeway. You don't get trees and those kind of things that create buffers for pollution and noise and stuff. You don't get that unless you have property values that are at a certain level.
Okay.
So if you notice going through Detroit freeways, if you don't see walls and you don't see trees, it's likely that your property values don't match what the state says. That's an environmental racist thing. Because you go along the I-75 corridor, you get outside the city of Detroit, honey, you're going to see all kinds of barriers and trees and whatever. But not in our neighborhoods, not in our community. And these are state dollars. This is not city dollars. These are federal highway and state dollars. Right? So it's those sort of systemic sort of policy things that people don't really know about that contribute to the burden that we face, right? So until we change those kind of policies, we're still in a bad shape in the state and in the city, because the hot spot is still the city in the county of Wayne. Okay? So, yeah. But I'm crazy in this way. I mean, you know, to get into this kind of work, you got to be kind of crazy. Because I still believe, you know, we have the power and the ability to make change, right? And, you know, in this time that I occupy, that's my goal. is to make those improvements, you know, along the way, do what I'm supposed to and pass the baton when it's time to pass the baton so that the work can be done, you know. But you know, I have hope. I gotta have always have hope, because otherwise, you know, I walk away from this stuff feeling pretty deprived and depressed and whatever, but I refuse to do that, and I want people to understand. I'm just a girl from Detroit. Nothing special behind her name or anything. And if I can do it, you can.
Right.
And that's our obligation, our responsibility, okay. Right? To be your own voice. That's the main message for me.
Okay. That's interesting. And I know that you had mentioned before, like, some of the environmental factors that help to lead to, like, illnesses and
yes.
diseases within the Black community, such as, you know, high infant mortality
mm-hmm.
rates, asthma, and so forth. And I found that really interesting, and especially how you brought up the idea of environmental racism, because a few years ago, probably about 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with sarcoidosis,
mm-hmm.
pulmonary sarcoidosis. Mm-hmm. I couldn't figure out, like, you know, where
did
that come from.
Smoking or anything, right?
No, and the doctors, you know, I had several doctors look at me, and they just all told me that they don't know where it comes from, so to speak, but it is very common amongst African-American women that live in urban environments. So I thought, okay, well, it's something in the air, but, you know, I took the doctor's word for
mm-hmm.
it. If they don't know where it comes from, then I guess nobody knows where it comes from. So just, you know, I guess speaking on that, are there any other types of illnesses that are prominent, like especially within urban areas or
mm-hmm.
African-American
mm-hmm.
communities that are a result of our environmental woes?
Well, let me put a disclaimer out here and first say this. We can never say it's an absolute that it's linked to.
Right.
Right? I'm going to say that first. But there's a lot of illnesses that have been borne by our community that are now known to have links to environmental exposure.
Okay.
High blood pressure, hypertension. In fact, they have found studies to show that if you're an older person with high blood pressure, you're more than likely they're able to link early exposure to lead poisoning.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's one example. Diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain things that come from chemicals from factories and stuff that mimic itself as diabetes in a person's body.
Okay.
Okay. They link that. Lupus.
Mm. Okay.
They've linked that. Let me see, what else? We know asthma has been a real linkage, particularly diesel fumes and that stuff like that. Of course, birth outcomes, they're leaking some of that. So it's a lot of things that are being, sort of, we're being blamed as being responsible for, and that's sort of the premise of public health. It's about human responsibility. You got to be responsible for your health. Stop drinking, stop smoking, better exercise. All those things are really important. But if you live in an environment, a built environment, that doesn't lend itself to a place for you to get healthy exercise, to walk, to feel safe, and all of that, then on top of that, we call it, some people call it residential apartheid. Don't access to quality, healthy foods.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No access to an automobile or a vehicle that'll get you to places where you get access to quality and healthy food.
Absolutely.
So you're stuck buying food from gas stations and things like that. Okay? Corner stores. And you're paying more for it than anybody else, and you're getting the least quality. So all those things matter. That's why we look at it holistically, and that's why we get on the nerves of policymakers. Because they're like, that's not environment. Right. We define the environment, where we live, where we work, where we play, where we pray. This is our environment, right? And these are the things in our environment that's contributing to poor outcomes in our community. We are challenging, you know, this. So to this issue of doctors, most of them only required to have a couple hours in their whole educational career around environmental or occupational medicine education. They don't know. So we have to be our own advocate. We have to bring information to them. Here's where I live, and this is what my neighborhood looks like. And a lot of times our community don't know that. So we do what we call environmental justice tours and stuff like that. We help people understand their community through our eyes.
Okay.
Because it's so normal. We're accustomed to it. We don't know that this is not a normal way to live. Like, to live near factory is not normal. You don't build factories in all white communities.
No. Very seldom do you ever see that.
You understand? Mm-hmm. You don't even dissect white communities with freeways. You don't do these things in places where people exist that matter. Mm-hmm. And so our community, once they get the information, they become on fire. You know, it's like, well, what can I do about this? Right? I talk about this one young man all the time. Well, he was a boy. He wasn't a man. Xavier Joe, a few years ago, was 10 years old. He became famous because Xavier Joe could not breathe. He died in his mother's arms in Southfield. And the people, rightfully so, we were all focused on, at the time, on what was going on. What was going on is that an ambulance couldn't get to him. And that's how you remember Xavier. But for me, the thing was, what was he suffering from? He couldn't breathe because he had asthma. Mm-hmm. And there's too many children that don't make it because they can't breathe. That's a preventable disease. So on top of not having access to the emergency vehicle, the fact that he couldn't breathe should be the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And his mom couldn't get him to a hospital. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we need to have clean air. Right? So everybody said, well, you know, people got all these other issues trying to survive and stuff. Yeah, but if you can't breathe, you can't survive.
Right. It's kind of essential.
You understand? Just like safe drinking water. You can't get access to some drinking water. What's the point of surviving?
Exactly.
So those are the tenets of environmental justice. Public health moves our agenda. Number one. And we've been criminalized and everything. Extremists, whatever. Mm-hmm. And all we're talking about is improving public health for everybody. And looking at the environment as a venue to do that. Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So my kids deserve to breathe clean air. Just like your kids. Mm-hmm. They deserve to be on playgrounds free from lead poisoning and that kind of stuff. They deserve to be in schools where they can learn and not be exposed. They deserve to live in homes and houses that are not contaminated. They deserve to be able to play outside and not breathe ozone and other things like that. Yeah, our kids deserve that. That's a basic human right. So we have appealed to the nations, you know, the World Health Organizations, the United Nations and stuff is saying, and we've accused the United States of failing to meet a human rights mandate.
Mm-hmm. And that is interesting because in many cases, the United States is usually the one accusing other people.
Exactly.
You know, that's definitely interesting. And a lot of people, you know, I guess like you said, just really aren't aware, you know, of all these environmental factors that contribute to a lot of our poor health, not just our physical health, but our mental health as well. So, and I believe that, you know, in many cases, people may ponder the idea, mm-hmm. but they're not able to really make the connection because not educated, you know, on such things. So that's very interesting. And then, I mean, that makes me think about a lot of things because I actually live here in the city. I live in Midtown.
Okay.
And I live in an old building.
Okay.
It's almost 100 years old.
Where do you live?
I live actually on Seward, just past the boulevard, right off of Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're trying to do some things to, mm-hmm. I guess, improve the community, you know, physically.
Oh, yeah,
you
know. It's a nice neighborhood over there, actually. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the actual environment, because there is a lot of smog and they still have a lot of buildings that are, you know, dilapidated.
Sure.
And they're in the process of, I guess, trying to, you know, refurbish those, mm-hmm. buildings. So it kind of makes me wonder about some of the things that are going on, mm-hmm. in the environment over there, in the air we breathe. So, and it also, you know, bringing up the point that you made about, I guess, like lead poisoning and so forth, contributing to violence, you know, and a lot of, you know, in a lot of communities.
That's right.
It's really interesting because a lot of people say, boy, it must be something in the air. It really is.
It really is.
So.
Right. It really is. And it's like, okay, what are you going to do about it? And so instead of waiting for other people to do it, that's, again, this idea of being the model for it, is like, we got to do it. We can't wait for other people because other people are working to achieve their agendas.
Right.
Whatever that is. We have to work to assure that we have an agenda and fight for that agenda.
Okay. Now, in regards to, I guess, fighting for this agenda and becoming more active, you know, within in environmental safety issues, what other type of advice would you give someone that was perhaps interested in learning more, you know, about, you know, our environment and what they can do to actually help fight, you know, pollution and so forth right. within our city?
Well, I put a shameless plug out there. They can join organizations like Green Door Initiative, get involved, and become active. And the first way to do that is to learn. So we can come to any community, whether it's a church or school or neighborhood block club, and do presentations. We have several curriculum that we share in the community that can be pretty technical, but we break it down so people can understand it. For instance, we have a curriculum called Understanding Reporting Environmental Releases, how to do that, who's supposed to protect you, what agency in the city of Detroit do you go to if you think there's a violation of the Clean Air Act. If you see black smoke, what does that mean? When if it's coming out of a stack or something like that, how about that's a violation of the Clean Air Act? So we really teach them about how to recognize environmental issues and what may be in violation of the law. So another area that we focus on is we call it toxic use reduction. So we teach them how to be better consumers. So say if you're doing things, you're purchasing items that could trigger an asthma attack in your home. But you know, you're using the cleaning products and you want your house to be clean, but you don't know that's harming you and your family. So what are the alternatives that you can use and buy and be in charge of as a consumer? In addition to that, toxic use reduction lends itself to having conversations with plant managers and folks in your community so that they can function and operate at the best level possible. So if there's a voice coming from the community saying, look, okay, we'd like to see you operate your facility like you do in Europe.
Okay.
Right? Because you adhere to those laws, so the capacity is there for you to do it here, you know. So you may not have to be able to shut down a facility, but you can get that facility to honor you and be a good neighbor in your community.
Okay.
We have a program that understanding PVTs or persistent bioaccumulate toxins. But really what that is what does it mean to be part of the food chain around mercury, heavy metals like lead and those kind of things. How does that really affect our environment and our health and whatever? Learning about those things so you can be able to articulate that if you got to go to the doctor and those kind of things. Then we link up with entities like the University of Michigan and other places where we're teaching people how to be policy advocates. So you go through training around that, and now you can help push a policy through. And it may be you don't want to get involved in all that, but if you'd be willing to sign a postcard and help us send some postcards to Governor Snyder, get that executive order assigned for environmental justice in the state.
Okay.
You know, so there are little things and big things you can do, you know, to get the job done. We just need to add more people to the work. You may want to start your own sort of effort in your own neighborhood. Well, we could come out and help you get organized around that or whatever.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we would do. I mean, you're here on a Friday, it's kind of slow. People are not here, whatever. But we have folks that, you know, go out to the community and do these trainings as well. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess my last question would be, how would or could someone contact the Green Door Initiative?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're easy to reach. You can find us via the website, greendoorinitiative.org. You can contact us our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page, DGDI. Or Detroit Green Door Initiative. You can contact us directly, call us, or email us. We're approachable, easy to connect to. I love being located here. This is the mecca of community, as far as we're concerned, and lots of organizations, lots of regular residents, whatever, in and out of this place. So we're easy to find, and definitely give us a call, look us up. We don't turn anybody away.
Okay, good. Okay, great. And also, too, in relation to your site, anyone can basically go to your site as well to kind of get advice on the types of products that they can use in their home and
so forth
that are safe for the environment.
That. we have to improve that element, but yeah, that's ultimately our goal, is to make those lists available. We do have a non-toxic cleaning guide that we make available to people. And during the summer, we're really out there promoting that. We give it away. We give away, we like to do this, my favorite raffle is the bucket of clean alternative green products and that kind of stuff. But yeah, we are definitely trying to keep our stuff updated and linking to other resources that have like safe toys and things for babies that are not toxic and other items and stuff that will, you know, reduce the kind of toxic chemicals and stuff you may bring into your home.
Okay. Well, sounds good. And I know that there is also plenty of other resources as well, such as links to different types of reports and organizations that you guys are collaborating with in order to, I guess, help Detroit and I guess Michigan and, you know, worldwide have a healthy and safe environment. So
Absolutely. So, yeah, again, our mission is to ensure that everyone is environmentally literate, capable of promoting and maintaining a sustainable lifestyle. That's our goal. And if we can equip everyone to do that, then we can protect our community from these environmental assaults.
Okay. All right. I guess that'll actually conclude our interview. You've definitely helped out a lot, providing with a wealth of information. You've also provided our readers and listeners with a host of information to consider. And I'd like to, you know, once again, thank you. But before I conclude our session, is there anything else that you would like to share?
The only thing I would add is that we're looking forward to joining forces with anyone who, as a result of this report, who wants to make a difference in the city of Detroit when it comes to environmental quality and environmental protection.
Okay.
Our doors, the green doors are open.
Well, excellent. All right, Ms. Wilkins, you know, once again, I'd like to thank you for your time. So I've learned a lot, and I've actually, you know, really enjoyed, like, listening and learning from you as well. So, and I'm definitely going to keep in mind some of the things that you have taught me and kind of apply them to my own life as well.
Awesome.
So, and hopefully others will do the same.
Thanks again, Nicole.
Oh, thank you. You're very welcome.